taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. Hope you guys are all doing well. Today's episode, we are talking about a very remarkable woman whose efforts you probably have seen in your daily life. And it's all advertising based. So we're talking about the roaring times of advertising, the 1960s. If you guys have seen Mad Men, you'll know the drill. We'll talk about it a bit more in a few minutes. But yeah, so we're going back to the 1960s today. We are talking about Mary Wells Lawrence. You probably have never heard of her before, unless you maybe took an advertising class or two in college. But even still, like I did that, and I don't remember her name for some reason. I don't know why. Now I will, now that I've done this research and I've read so much about her. But if you guys have heard of the I Heart New York campaign, or if you've seen it, if you've ever been to Times Square, if you've ever even just seen a photo of, like, you know, New York City tourism at any capacity, you've seen I Heart, like the I Heart NY emblem. It's very synonymous with New York, with New York City. She created that. You know, she worked on that campaign. So we're going to talk about her today, all the things that she did, the way that she, you know, created this name for herself in the industry. And she was a woman. So that is saying a lot, especially in the 1960s. So yeah, I'm just going to get right to it because I'm very excited and passionate about this story. So I think we just mosey right on into it. What do you guys say? I think we do it. Okay, let's go. So advertising has always been the cornerstone of business. The bottom line is, you know, it's critical to drive customer demand for a product. You can have an amazing product, but no traction. Consumers, customers don't know that it exists, and, you know, it doesn't matter how great the product is if customers are not fed, you know, a breadcrumb trail towards your product, you know. So the sales and the financial health of a product, and hence a company, can be traced back to consumer awareness, and consumer awareness is developed via marketing and advertising techniques. But the days of advertising agencies, the way that we know of them as being depicted on TV and such, seem to be behind us. Instead, in today's day and age, if you know anyone who works in marketing, they will tell you, you know, new marketers are taught the importance of digital and targeted ads, you know, social media influencers, consumer-centric content, and, you know, UGC, user-generated content, utilization of big data, you know, all of these other things that are more, you know, current that ad agencies of the past never had to learn or know, because that just wasn't how things were. You know, the focus is no longer on these blanket ads in print or TV, but rather on customized ad experiences right in the palm of your hand on social media, you know, seeing an ad that you might not even know is an ad. Like, it's not even obvious anymore when things are ads, which is a problem. But however, this pivot away from ad agencies to whatever the heck things are at currently doesn't mean we can't take a trip down memory lane and, you know, kind of remind ourselves of what the ad industry used to look like, because, you know, it's been kind of glamorized, or at least just, you know, story told about on shows like Mad Men, you know, from the 60s, 1960s, New York City. I loved that show when I first moved to New York City. I watched that show, like, I binged it. And now and again, I'll still go back and watch episodes. I feel like it's honestly now, like, looking back, it's kind of sad. It really is sad, you know, how toxic the industry was back then. But it also is really, it's nostalgic. Like, there is a hint of nostalgia in there. It is interesting seeing New York City in this time and kind of reminding myself, like, oh my God, it is so much better being a woman now versus the 1960s. Like, you know, night and day, really. But from what I've gathered, Mad Men really does do the ad industry of the 1960s justice. It was a time fraught with cutthroat creative environments and high-stakes client interactions. Three martini lunches. Have you ever heard of a three martini lunch? I actually learned that phrase from my dad because he was reading this book called Three Martini Lunch, and I was like, three martinis at lunch? Like, don't these people have to be at work like in an hour and, you know, functioning on client calls? And he's like, yeah, that's kind of like the point. Like, everyone was drunk all the time in the ad industry. They'd have like just mini bars all over the place in the office, like just bottles upon bottles of like rum and whiskey and all sorts of things in their desk drawers. Like, they'd smoke a pack a day minimum, like all sorts of things like that. But yeah, three martini lunch is pretty much what it sounds like. It's like you would have three martinis at lunch and go back to the office, and no one thought it to be, you know, unprofessional in any way. That was just how things were. So yeah, it was a fast-paced environment, and everyone was just chasing the next big idea. They were wordsmiths. They were trying to, you know, create riddles and, you know, what's it called? Like illusions, create illusions with imagery. And it really took so much creativity to be in the ad industry in the 1960s. And like half of them were drunk the whole time. So it's just really crazy when you think about it. But all of that aside, one of the great pioneers of advertising at the time was none other than a woman named Mary Wells Lawrence. And today we are going to be sharing her story because she is remarkable in so many different ways. We're going to talk about a bunch of different ad campaigns that she worked on, how she came up with the ideas, and, you know, what has become of them today, because some of them are still in use today. And she was also a woman in a very cutthroat, male-dominated, booze-filled industry, so there's a lot to say about her. So let's start at the very beginning with her origin story. Mary Wells Lawrence was born on May 25th, 1928 in Youngstown, Ohio, a city known for its steel mills and hardworking residents. Growing up in this industrious environment, Mary learned the values of perseverance and determination from a very young age. Her parents instilled in her a strong work ethic, which would become a cornerstone of her future success. Mary's passion for creative thinking and drama was evident from a young age. Honestly, I see a lot of myself in her. I was the same way as a kid. But she had a very natural flair, even at a young age, for storytelling and a very vivid imagination. And these traits led Mary to Carnegie Mellon University, where she pursued a degree in drama. Little did she know that this background would later influence her approach to advertising. So she studied drama in college. That was her degree at Carnegie Mellon. But it's interesting because now, you know, I'm sure there wasn't even, well, I'd have to do more research, but I'm wondering if there was even an advertising degree available to women at this time. Like, there's a very strong possibility that there wasn't. Also just advertising degrees. I wonder if those were as common as they are today. But regardless, so she studied drama and then she graduated. And after graduating, Mary's first job was as a copywriter at McKelvey's department store in her hometown. And here at this department store, she learned the basics of advertising and honed in her writing skills. Soon, she wanted more. She'd caught the advertising bug. She found her shtick, found her thing, and she really wanted to work outside the confines of her hometown. She wanted to get out. She wanted to expand her horizons, and so she did what a lot of people did and still do, myself included. She moved to New York City, the epicenter of the advertising world. In 1953, Mary joined McCann Erickson, one of the top advertising agencies at the time, and her talent quickly became apparent to everyone around her. She was really crushing it, and so she moved on from McCann Erickson to work at DDB, Doyle Dane Birnbach, in 1957, where she would make her first major mark. At DDB, which is what I'm going to call it because it's a mouthful. At DDB, Mary worked under the legendary Bill Birnbach, whose philosophy of creative advertising deeply influenced her. So she was kind of his protege. And by 1963, she became a $40,000 a year vice president at DDB, at the company. So yeah, she was Bill Birnbach's protege and then went on to make a killing by 1963. So to put things into perspective, she came to New York City in 1953, so this was, it took 10 years for her to get to this point. But $40,000 a year back in 1963 would be about $400,000 a year today. So she was crushing it. At DDB, Mary thrived. She was part of a team that revolutionized advertising by focusing on making ads simple and witty. Simple and witty. One of her most notable contributions during this time period was the End of the Plain Plain campaign for Braniff International Airways. So this is the first campaign we're going to talk about that she worked on. So to give some background, Braniff International Airways was a little-known airline that flew from Mexico and South America. Braniff had invested in new planes, and its new president, Harding L. Lawrence, was desperate for recognition. And Mary actually recalled in her memoir the following interaction that they had. So he came to Mary and said, quote, "Listen, Mary, I need a very big idea for this airline, something so big it'll make Braniff important news overnight." And so Mary took this very seriously. She actually went to Braniff's terminals in person, examined the planes and the staff, and came away feeling, quote, dismayed. The terminals, quote, looked like a prison camp, she said. The planes were drab, metallic or white. Flight attendants were, quote, dressed to look like nurses. So yeah, it wasn't looking like they had much material to work with at the time. And Mary was like, okay, we're going to have to get really creative here to make this drab airline, you know, seem exciting, seem like someone would actually want to buy a ticket to fly on it. And then it came to her. It came to Mary, this magical idea to exploit the 1960s culture of, quote, rebel freedom, eccentricity, and vitality. So just kind of like the ideals of the 1960s, what was hot, what was cool in the 1960s. And it was color. It was a lot of color, you know, a lot going on, patterns. If you think of just any sort of design aspects of the 1960s, if you've seen, like, you know, the way they used to even decorate their houses in the 1960s versus today, like, there was color going on. There were, like, shag rugs and things, if I'm not mistaken. And so she said she, quote, saw Braniff in a wash of beautiful color. She envisioned a bold and vibrant makeover for Braniff that would differentiate it from its competitors. The concept was to infuse the brand with a sense of flair, sophistication, and excitement, and it aimed to make flying with Braniff an experience, not just a mode of transportation, which, you know, I feel like the Deltas and JetBlue and United, all those airlines today that I see, you know, their branding and marketing strategies, like it seems kind of to be very similar today. Like they, you know, these airlines want it to be an experiential sort of thing. It's like not just getting on the flight and paying the money to go on the flight. It's like, oh, we also have a lounge. You know, if you upgrade to this, you can get the fresh towels and the cucumber hand towels. I love the cucumber hand towels. And things like that. So it becomes an experience. And then, you know, Delta, for example, I know a lot about Delta because I fly them majority of the time and I've actually worked with them. And they love to kind of emphasize the fact that they, you know, partner with all these dining institutions, Resy, and they have like different hotel partners and things like that. So it becomes this like full scope situation. But back then that was not a thing. Like back then an airline was an airline and that's kind of it. Like, of course there was like different, if you see photos of like old airlines or airplanes rather with like people on them looking fantastic, like not even wearing seatbelts, being served caviar and like filet mignon, you know, that was certainly the experience on some specific planes, but not all. And, you know, it was a different experience back then, less comfortable, I'd say, for most people. And so she was trying to take the typical, what was typical at the time, and, you know, this airline that was really struggling, and give it some pizzazz, which, you know, now nearly every airline has a bit of pizzazz if you pay the right dollar. But anyway, so that was from a New York Times article. So Mary essentially worked on the redesign of Braniff's aircraft. Like, not only did she create ads for them, but she kind of inserted herself and was like, we need to overhaul this entire thing. Like, we need to redo the planes, redo the outfits, redo everything before, like, to give ourselves a good foundation for this campaign. So she collaborated with renowned designer Alexander Girard to create a new visual identity for the airline. And he introduced a bold color scheme, painting the planes in bright, unconventional colors like turquoise, lemon yellow, and orange. And this was a stark departure from the traditional conservative designs of the time. So, you know, it was definitely eye-catching what they landed on for the actual plane wrap. And then the flight attendants' uniforms were also redesigned by fashion designer Emilio Pucci. Yes, Pucci flight attendant outfits. My first thought when I was reading this is that these outfits must be worth a fortune today. Like, if you have an authentic Emilio Pucci flight attendant uniform from the 60s, let me know, because I'm taking it to Antiques Roadshow. It's going to be worth a ton. Anyway, so the new uniforms featured bright colors and modern stylish designs, and they weren't only fashionable but also practical, with interchangeable pieces that allowed flight attendants to mix and match outfits throughout the flight. So they can like make outfit changes throughout the flight or based on if they're hot or cold or things like that. And because of that, Mary and the team, their gears were turning again, and they created this commercial campaign called the Airstrip. And in this ad, a flight attendant performed a playful and stylish, quote, strip tease, yes, to demonstrate the versatility of the new uniforms. So she would, like, you know, remove layers of clothing from the uniform, which was its design. That was how Pucci designed it. But obviously something like this would never happen today. Like, you know, sex sells, they say. And in the 60s, they really leaned into that. So they had the flight attendant, like, do a playful and stylish strip tease in the commercial. And as she removed layers of clothing, she revealed the different parts of the uniform, highlighting Emilio Pucci's design. And the commercial was, quote, playful, sophisticated, and attention-grabbing, perfectly encapsulating the spirit of the campaign. So it ultimately was successful. And when all was said and done, the entire branding strategy for Braniff was overhauled by Mary and her team. The interiors of the planes were redesigned too to match the vibrant exteriors. So they brought the colors inside the plane as well, creating a cohesive and immersive brand experience for the people traveling on the plane. And the marketing materials like print ads, brochures, and television commercials were all consistent with this idea of like vibrancy, color, and emphasized this new stylish image of Braniff, like, you know, modern for the times. So the end of the plane was the tagline that Mary came up with for the airline. And it was plane, PLAINPLANE, obviously. So the end of the plane. And because of this, because of the whole overhaul of the colors and the outfits and all of the stuff, plus the print ads, Braniff suddenly became the it airline of the time, reporting an 80% leap in business. So this was during the 60s. They were thriving for a time there, really, you know, came into their own, changed the way that airlines looked at the time. But it would kind of eventually all come crashing down, because I actually found that Braniff went out of business just like 20-ish years later in 1982 because of many different things, but primarily the competition of larger airlines. So it wasn't Mary's fault per se. She, you know, gave them some life towards the end, but yeah, really interesting, like, first boom for Mary Wells Lawrence that is notable that we read about today. But there's many more things to discuss. So let's get into her next campaign. She has a lot that we're going to talk about, so strap in. Anyway, while she was at DDB, the agency that she was making the big bucks at, she did a lot of different things, not just the Braniff campaign. And her work earned her recognition and respect in the industry. She was known for her ability to create ads that resonated with audience on an emotional level, blending drama and storytelling in a way that was both captivating and effective. So kind of utilizing her college degree in a way of, you know, she studied drama, so she brought that into her ads. And so in 1964, Mary switched gears and took a different job. She took a $60,000 a year senior partnership with Jack Tinker and Partners, one of the many agencies in the Interpublic Group. And the job, she told Fortune magazine, held, quote, the promise of eventual command. So her goal, like, she was doing well at DDB, you know, doing well at all these different places that she landed, but she wanted to be in a leadership role. Like, that is what she saw for herself. That was the goal. It wasn't the money. It was like she wanted a leadership role. And so she saw this as like a natural next step, kind of a stepping stone into what she ultimately wanted. So she was at Jack Tinker and Partners, and she and a small group, including Dick Rich and Stuart Green, known as, quote, Tinker's Thinkers, rented an office away from Madison Avenue's bustle and devised the early renditions of the Alka-Seltzer and Braniff campaign. So continuing on with the plain stuff. So come 1966, this is just 2 years after she started at the company. So she got her new job. She was there for 2 years. She did a lot. Like she, you know, got a lot of high profile campaigns. She brought in like Braniff Airlines with her to the company. So she, you know, had a lot going on. She'd done a lot. She'd really proven herself. And so it was at that point that Mary Wells Lawrence asked for the presidency of Tinker and Partners. Yeah, the confidence that this woman had. Her boss, Marion Harper Jr., the president and chairman of Interpublic, told her that he would give her presidential authority, but not the title. So he essentially was like, we'll give you all the roles and responsibilities that a president would have, but we're not going to call you publicly the president. And it was because, I'm sure you've already guessed it, he said a woman could not win acceptance as president. So, yeah, here we go. Here we go. Strap in. Mary was not happy about this. And it was truthfully, like really that moment for her where she kind of felt the world or the earth stop spinning for a second. And she's like, my God, this is really happening right now. Like this man says I'm qualified, knows I'm qualified, but won't give me the actual like public facing job because I am a woman. So then she told the Times in 2012, when she was reflecting on her life, that in that moment, quote, he could see that I was feeling a red rage. And then he said, quote, you wouldn't want to ruin something you built. And at that point, I just walked out the door. It wasn't as though I wanted to be a Betty Friedan. I just wanted my own agency. And if you're wondering who Betty Friedan is and why she just name dropped her, obviously, she's probably a figure worth noting if Mary literally quoted her in this Times article in 2012. But a little background, Betty Friedan was an influential American feminist, writer, activist, best known for her 1963 book, The Feminine Mystique. You've probably heard of it. And this book is often credited with sparking the second wave of feminism in the U.S. And she also co-founded the National Organization for Women in 1966, serving as its first president. And she played a key role in advocating for women's rights like workplace equality, reproductive rights, and social justice. So Mary Wells Lawrence, in her quote, she said, you know, it wasn't as though I wanted to be Betty Friedan. I just wanted my own agency. So she's kind of saying like, you know, sure, she was probably a feminist, but she's like, I wasn't trying to like make a big thing out of it. You know, I just wanted my own agency and it was unfair. So that's exactly what she did. In 1966, Mary Wells made a bold move that would change the course of her career. With the aid of Dick Rich and Stuart Green, who you might recognize as being those two guys that she got in office with when she was at Tinker and Partners and she worked alongside them, like they were kind of a team. With the aid of Dick and Stuart, she founded her own advertising agency, Wells Rich Green. So they kind of came together and were like, let's do our own thing. Mr. Rich joined her as treasurer and copy chief of the new agency, Mr. Green as secretary and art director, and they set up shop in a hotel suite, signed Braniff Airlines as their first client, and soon won Benson & Hedges, Burma Toiletries, and Utica Club Beer. And if you guys watched Mad Men, you actually might remember one specific character, Peggy Olson, and a lot of people say that she is based off of Mary Wells Lawrence and the way that she, you know, left the big agency to do her own thing. So anyway, this endeavor made Mary Wells Lawrence one of the first women to head a major agency. And this was a groundbreaking achievement in this industry that, like I said, was so dominated by men.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
WRG, which is what I'm going to call it, Wells Rich Green, quickly established itself as a powerhouse of creativity. Mary's leadership style was bold and visionary, encouraging her team to push the boundaries of traditional advertising. The agency attracted high-profile clients like Procter & Gamble, Ford, and Alka-Seltzer, producing some of the most memorable campaigns of the era. So Mary worked with Alka-Seltzer during the 60s and 70s, and she had to get really creative with this brand because by the 60s, Alka-Seltzer's bottom line was taking a major punch to the gut. Well, if you guys don't know what Alka-Seltzer is, it's, the things that they were advertising at the time were these little tablets that you still use today. Tablets you put in water and they relieve heartburn and acid indigestion, things like that. So, but at the time in the 60s, this whole concept of, you know, relieving heartburn and acid indigestion was suffering this image problem, especially with younger people, younger buyers. People didn't want to be seen buying these types of things at the store because it was either, you know, reminiscent of something that their parents had bought, or, you know, it kind of signaled this overindulgence culture of like, oh, we're going to eat so much, we have indigestion, so we need to buy these things. Like, it just wasn't really attractive to be purchasing things like this. And so people, you know, either didn't or like were very secretive about it, which is kind of weird thinking about it now. It's like, I have no shame like buying Tums, you know, or things I'm like, yeah, no, I need these. I need them. So the agency was tasked with, you know, making Alka-Seltzer cool, essentially. So they worked on this campaign called the Plop Plop Fizz Fizz campaign. And so this concept had been kind of fleshed out years earlier in 1951, but it was popularized and transformed under Mary Wells Lawrence's direction in the late 60s. And the campaign featured a catchy jingle that became synonymous with the brand. And it goes, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. And this jingle perfectly captured the product's essence in a simple and memorable way. And just speaking of jingles, it's funny because I feel like jingles were such a thing in the early 2000s. I mean, sure, you know, you still hear a new one come up here and there in today's world. I guess the new thing is like TikTok sounds and whatnot, but, you know, it's a whole other beast. But I remember certain very memorable jingles, like lines from commercials that just get stuck in my head that I can't get out even all these years later. Like, I memorize these certain, like, honestly, the ones that come to mind are like very local to where I grew up, like carpet cleaners and like different household products and things that just the jingles are stuck in my head. And so this was one of the first very memorable jingles in the 60s, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. So the campaign aimed to highlight the effervescent action of Alka-Seltzer tablets when they're dropped into water. You know, someone definitely was trying to get creative. Maybe Mary Wells Lawrence or someone that worked for her was probably staring at, you know, this cup of water as they were dropping in the tablets thinking, okay, what can we do with this? How can we make this interesting? How can we remind people how it feels to drink something like this, or how it looks, or how what the sensation is, like what your senses are doing? And so they took all of that and came up with plop plop fizz fizz, hoping that people would watch these ads and would read the print ads and think to themselves, ooh, I could really use that right now. Like, that looks like something I could use right now. And so the catchy jingle was paired with humorous and relatable television commercials that depicted everyday scenarios where Alka-Seltzer could provide relief. And it was a huge success. The jingle became ingrained in popular culture, and the commercials resonated with a broad audience, making Alka-Seltzer a household name. And the reason why they were so successful, in my opinion and many people's opinions, is the fact that they were so relatable and funny. Like, they weren't super sterile advertisements, you know, very clinical, talking about the medical effects of these things. Certainly laws were different back then, but, you know, they really honed in on these very real, very normal, like, you know, you eat a big Thanksgiving meal, what do you want? Your Alka-Seltzer. Like, they were very relatable in that way, and that hadn't really been done before. And so that was kind of where the success came from. That whole concept of relatability and humor. It was funny. And the jingle, obviously the jingle. Another notable campaign developed by Mary for Alka-Seltzer, so that was just one of the campaigns. Another one was the, quote, I can't believe I ate the whole thing campaign in 1972. And this one featured a series of commercials where characters would lament overindulgences in food, followed by the tagline, I can't believe I ate the whole thing. And of course, the solution was Alka-Seltzer. So it would show someone, you know, eating a whole pie or something. Oh, why did I do that? I can't believe I ate the whole thing. Alka-Seltzer is the solution. And the phrase, I can't believe I ate the whole thing, actually became part of everyday vernacular, demonstrating the campaign's deep cultural impact. So people would just, you know, say it to themselves, oh, I can't believe I ate the whole thing. Like, I guess this hadn't been a phrase that people had used a lot. I don't know, question mark. But it just became, I guess, one of those funny pop culture things that people would say often. And so this, you know, skyrocketed the sales of Alka-Seltzer and the brand's visibility and recognition. Its household name-ness grew even stronger. Mary's creative genius and strategic insight were key to the Alka-Seltzer campaign's success, and her work continues to inspire advertisers and marketers today. So the concept of how she really brought that relatability aspect into her ads and the drama, the humor of it all, is something that's still being studied, like, today. So yeah, Alka-Seltzer was a big, big part of her work. But another one that I'm sure you're just dying to hear about that I talked about in the intro is the I Love New York campaign, created in 1977. It was conceived to rebrand New York as a vibrant and welcoming destination. And Mary played a huge role in shaping the campaign's vision and direction. And this is what really put her on the map. And the goal with this campaign was to create a message that was simple, memorable, and emotionally resonant. And I Heart New York is exactly that. I mean, of course, I live here, but I see at least one I Heart New York. And I don't live anywhere near Times Square where, you know, you can't go a single, like, three steps without seeing an I Heart New York shirt or something of that nature. But I see and think about I Heart New York all the time, like every single day. And I'm sure, you know, when people think of New York City, they think of that iconic I Heart New York, the black text, the red heart. Like, you see it in your mind right now as I'm describing it. But back in the 70s, you know, people didn't see New York City in the way that they see it now. New York City was struggling with this negative image. There was high crime rates, financial problems, and a decline in tourism. People were like, New York City, kind of dangerous, you know, not very clean, not as exciting as people see it being today. Of course, I'm biased, but, you know, to revitalize its image and attract visitors, the New York State Department of Commerce sought the expertise of Mary and her agency, Wells Rich Green. They're like, please help us make New York City cool again. The campaign's iconic logo, featuring the words I Heart New York in a bold sans-serif font, was designed by graphic artist Milton Glaser. The logo's simplicity and charm perfectly captures the spirit of the campaign. The red heart symbolizes, of course, love and passion, while the clean typography conveyed modernity and clarity. So it really just looks good, right? It looks good. The campaign was launched with a series of television commercials, print ads, and promotional materials. And I'm going to put a bunch of this stuff over on the Instagram, all the campaigns I'm talking about. If you guys want to see any of the stuff I'm talking about, go to Found Objects Podcast Instagram. But the commercials for the I Heart New York campaign featured upbeat music, showing the diverse attractions of New York State, from the bustling streets of Manhattan to the scenic landscapes of upstate New York. And it's interesting because when I think of the I Heart New York, like, emblem, I think of it being New York City, but no, I think it was supposed to be for the entire state of New York, which is true. Like, if you think about it, it doesn't say I Heart NYC, it just says I Heart NY. I've never thought about it like that, but anyway, so the catchy jingle, I Love New York, reinforced the positive and uplifting message. So it's very simple, I love New York, but Mary Wells Lawrence was known for stuff like that, and it really hit. So to give you an idea of what the commercials looked like, because I've actually never seen an I Heart New York commercial. I don't know if they do those today, but back in the 70s, they made this commercial that was very famous, which ended with this known actor of the time playing Dracula. And it was shot with a machine-generated fog. So like a foggy kind of, you know, mysterious looking atmosphere on this street, on 54th Street, outside of this theater in Midtown. And the actor that was playing Dracula was swirling around in his Dracula cape. He looks into your eyes and says thrillingly, quote, I love New York, especially in the evening. So I don't know how they came up with that, but it is definitely, it's like, you're watching this commercial, you're like, okay, why is Dracula, what's Dracula doing in New York City? And then he's like, I love New York. You know, and that, I can't even replicate it, but the way that Dracula speaks, especially in the evening. So, and that wasn't the only commercial. There was many, many more to come featuring stars of Broadway, Hollywood, the Metropolitan Opera, political leaders, celebrities, and the I Love New York song, composed by Steve Carman, was declared the state anthem by Governor Hugh L. Carey in 1980. I've actually never heard the State of New York anthem. I'm going to have to listen to it. But so yeah, Mary's campaign crushed it, to say the least. People are still talking about it and wearing it to this day. My friend Danielle had a I Heart New York themed party for her birthday party like 3 years ago. So Mary's creative vision ensured that the campaign was more than just a slogan. It became a movement. The I Love New York logo was a widely embraced one by the public and quickly became a cultural icon. It appeared on merchandise, souvenirs, and promotional materials, further embedding itself into the public consciousness. And the campaign, of course, was a crazy success. It changed public perception of New York, boosting tourism and revitalizing the city's image. Her ability to blend creativity with strategic thinking, the drama, the simplicity, though, was evident in all of these campaigns. And she understood the power of a strong, simple message delivered with flair, with drama, and this approach resonated with consumers. So yeah, if you think about the Dracula commercial, it's like, I Heart New York, a very simple slogan, very simple look, but here comes Dracula in the streets of New York City with his cape, you know, flowing in the wind. So we have the drama, but the simplicity. However, every shining star has, of course, someone trying to dim their light. In other words, Mary had some fierce competition. Perhaps the biggest force to be reckoned with was the, quote, father of advertising himself, David Ogilvy. David's approach emphasized research, creative brilliance, and the importance of a brand's image. And this is epitomized in his most iconic campaign for Rolls-Royce. In the 1950s, Rolls-Royce was already known as a prestigious and luxury car brand, but the company sought to reinforce its image and appeal to a broader audience in the United States. So it was, you know, at the time, kind of targeted towards a very specific kind of demographic area, but they wanted to, you know, just expand, as any company does. And so they hired Ogilvy to create an ad that would not only highlight the car's luxury, but also its technical excellence and reliability. So his approach was rooted in deep research. Ogilvy spent a significant amount of time understanding the car, its engineering, and its target market. And he even went to the extent of reading technical manuals and speaking with engineers to gather detailed info about the car's features and performance, all those things. He essentially became an expert on the car. And the resulting advertisement featured one of the most famous headlines in advertising history, which is, quote, at 60 miles an hour, the loudest noise in this new Rolls-Royce comes from the electric clock. And this headline effectively captured the essence of the Rolls-Royce brand, quiet, refined luxury, combined with technical perfection. So this ad included a simple yet elegant photo of the Rolls-Royce, reinforcing that idea of sophistication and class. It was very clean, very, you know, by the book. So Ogilvy, the brains of that ad campaign, was one of Mary Wells Lawrence's competitors. She definitely opened the magazine, saw that, and was like, damn it. But I guess that he also did that in the 50s. So she was a bit younger at that time, but still. So that was something that was very impressive. But another competitor of Mary Wells Lawrence's was Leo Burnett. Burnett's agency, Leo Burnett Worldwide, developed memorable characters and campaigns, including the Marlboro Man, I can never say that, Marlboro, it's like obviously the cigarette guy, Tony the Tiger, and the Pillsbury Doughboy. And Leo was known for his belief in the power of strong, enduring brand icons. So yeah, if you think of Tony the Tiger, Pillsbury Doughboy, like these are very memorable from my childhood. Like I remember seeing them, not even being able to read, but seeing them on the box or the canister of the, what are those things called? Like the cinnamon rolls? Oh my God, cinnamon rolls. I loved the Pillsbury Doughboy cinnamon rolls. Anyway, so Leo, who believed in these characters, these strong brand characters to give brand awareness, you know, that was very impressive. And so one of the most enduring and successful campaigns in history that he spearheaded was for Kellogg's Frosted Flakes featuring Tony the Tiger. Tony was introduced in 1952 as the mascot for Kellogg's Frosted Flakes, originally called Sugar Frosted Flakes, and Tony the Tiger was created by Leo Burnett and his team, including art director Eugene Kolke and copywriter Art Myers. And Tony the Tiger was designed to be this friendly, strong, athletic tiger. His appearance and personality were intended to appeal to children while also conveying the message of energy and strength, you know, kind of signaling to parents that if we get this cereal for our kids, like they will have the energy, the fuel to take on the day and be just like Tony the Tiger. And the famous slogan, they're great, was coined to highlight the taste and quality of Frosted Flakes. The enthusiastic catchphrase, "They're great," became synonymous with Tony the Tiger and the brand, and the original voice of Tony the Tiger was provided by Dallas McKennon, but it was later perfected by Thurl Ravenscroft, whose deep, rich voice became iconic. So imagine being like the original Tony the Tiger and then like being given the boot because someone else has a better voice than you, and like people are like, I mean, that happens all the time, I guess, if you think about it, in animated craft, but just funny. It's like, no, you got the boot. Tony the Tiger 2.0 is coming in. But the ads typically featured Tony the Tiger engaging in various sports and activities, helping kids realize their potential or encouraging them to stay active and positive. And the message always tied back to Frosted Flakes being this nutritious and delicious way to start the day. Tony the Tiger quickly became one of the most recognizable mascots in advertising. His image and catchphrase were widely recognized and associated with positive attributes of the cereal. And over the years, Tony the Tiger has remained a constant presence with updates to his look and, you know, design and animation to keep him contemporary. But despite these changes, Tony the Tiger's core characteristics and the central message of the campaign, "They're great," have remained consistent over the years. While Tony was primarily an American creation, his appeal transcended borders, making Frosted Flakes a popular cereal in many cultures worldwide. So you may notice that each iconic advertiser that I've discussed here, Ogilvy, Leo Burnett, Mary Wells Lawrence, obviously, you know, they all have a very distinct style. And Mary's style was very much, you know, strategic creativity. That was her tagline. Mary's personal tagline was strategic creativity. Ogilvy focused on research and cohesive brand image. Leo Burnett focused on character-driven advertising. So completely different takes on advertising by these three individuals in the 60s, same time period, but all different takes, but all equally successful in their own right. This may seem like stiff competition for Mary with Ogilvy and Burnett, but let us not forget that she was truly the only female leader in the advertising field at this time. So, of course, being a woman in the workplace comes with its own set of challenges that men will never face, especially at that time. But, you know, she did the thing. And interestingly, her personal life, Mary's personal life, was as dynamic as her professional career. So she was married twice, first to Burt Wells, and then to Harding Lawrence. So her name, Mary Wells Lawrence, it combines both the last names of her husbands. And Harding Lawrence was actually the former CEO of Braniff International Airways. Yeah. So like that big client that she worked with to transform, you know, the whole airline and then continued to bring them along with her to all of her different agencies. So they married in 1967 at the height of Mary's career, just 1 year after she founded her own agency. Mary had two children and managed to balance her family life with her demanding career. In 1990, WRG, so Mary's agency with her two friends, was sold to the French holding company BDDP for $160 million. Which is about $385 million today. I can't even fathom that amount of money. Like, it's just crazy that she sold her company for that much, but it's kind of impressive. So this was in the 90s. So she was getting older, you know, and she wanted to embrace retirement. So she did that. She stepped down, she let this happen and embraced retirement. And if you're curious at all about how she was able to sell her company for that much money, because I certainly was. I was like, wow, that is a lot of money, $385 million today. Like what did she do to be able to, you know, attain that sort of selling price? So for context, she made a lot of great business decisions. I can never say that. Those two words together are tough to say. Business decisions, but so that definitely contributed. But she was also, they were billing $885 million a year with clients like IBM, Procter & Gamble, Ford, American Motors, Cadbury, Schweppes, MCI Communications, Hertz, Philip Morris, and Pan American and Transworld Airlines. So they had a lot of high-profile clients, so it's not extremely surprising. But after retiring, Mary's influence continued to be felt throughout the industry. She authored a memoir called A Big Life in Advertising, which provided insights into her career and the advertising world. Highly recommend reading it if you want to hear more about her life. This was kind of a SparkNotes version, even though, you know, we've talked a lot about her. But Mary's legacy is marked by numerous awards and honors. She was named Woman of the Year by the American Advertising Federation in 1971, and she was inducted into the Advertising Hall of Fame in 1999. Her contributions to advertising are immense, and her work continues to be studied and admired for its creativity, effectiveness, and lasting impact. And her story is one of talent, but also determination. You know, even though she hit the roadblock with that, you know, boss of her telling her that she will never be able to command a staff with, you know, being president, like, because she is a woman, very inspiring that she plowed on through that, didn't let that keep her down, and yet she spearheaded a lot of different campaigns that, you know, a lot of people probably looked at her and were like, a woman's doing that? Like, you know, just the environment, the feelings of the time. She persevered and, you know, did all this and also raised two children and got all these awards. Like, it's just really so impressive. So in reflecting on her journey, Mary often spoke about the importance of passion and perseverance. She believed that success came from a combination of hard work and the willingness to take risks. And her story is a testament to the power of believing in yourself and the impact that one person can have on an entire industry. The campaigns Mary spearheaded are still being celebrated as benchmarks of excellence in advertising to this day. And that is the story, guys, of Mary Wells Lawrence. I hope you appreciated this tale of Mary. She really is such a legend, and so much of what we see in advertising today, although the ad industry looks different, you know, a lot of the core beliefs of people that are creating advertising works remain, and a lot of those things were made possible because of Mary Wells Lawrence and her creativity, the way that she blended, you know, drama with simplicity and was able to tell these stories of these brands, like, you know, add pizzazz where there wasn't pizzazz, with the Emilio Pucci uniforms to plop plop fizz fizz, you know, Dracula to I Heart New York, like, so much. These are just a few of the campaigns that she worked on. Please pick up her book if you guys want to read more about what she did, what was made possible because of her. She really is such a legend, and I'm so glad that I was able to cover her today. So thank you all for listening to this episode of Found Objects, and come back next Wednesday for another episode. I always drop them Wednesday mornings. Follow us on Instagram to see some photos of the things I talked about in today's episode. And with that, guys, I guess I'll send you off onto your day. Don't forget, remember, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.